Our topic this evening is Exodus, God's people saved from enemies. Exodus has a double meaning as used here. That is, we're referring to the book of the Bible, but we're also referring to the event of deliverance from Egypt, God's mighty act in taking his people out of bondage and into freedom and life in the promised land. The overall theme which I am using this week is peace, how God saves from enemies. And in the earlier session this afternoon, in fact, one of you talked with me afterwards and helped me to believe that I had not been as specific enough in defining enemies. That is to say, when I use the term here, and as I think it is often, or perhaps usually used, in the book of Psalms, which we looked at this afternoon, I mean human enemies primarily. I don't mean primarily sickness, inflation, alcoholism, drugs, and those things which are also hostile to human welfare. But I'm using the term specifically in reference to human enemies. Furthermore, I'm using it most particularly in reference to enemies of the nation. I believe that the greatest problem of our time, of our age, is the problem of war. Our generation is the generation that is going to have to answer the question of war, perhaps as none before us. And I think we kid ourselves if we as Christians don't face squarely and talk about openly and directly the phenomenon and reality of national enemies called communists and communism. It is such a pervasive phenomenon in our society and has such tremendous impact on our life as you start from taxpayers to whatever else, and on the whole world, that we have to be, I think, very deliberate, very intentional about addressing the reality of national enemies. And for Americans, as the nation defines it for us anyway, that turns out to be enemies called communists and communism. And in the next four sessions, essentially what we'll be doing is looking at two possible responses to national enemies. One possible response is the military response. And I think basically, biblically, the other possible response is to deal with and accept the possibility of suffering. When we look at the book of Isaiah, we will, and that's tomorrow morning, we'll look at that kind of response to the threat that comes and the actions that come from national enemies, that is the response of suffering. But in all of this, I want to recover for the church the belief that God saves from national enemies. The definition and the nature of that salvation will not always be simplistically physical, but that is part of the challenge to understand the nature of and then the right ways in which God may save from national enemies, but to reestablish the faith of the church, which I believe is a biblical faith, that God has an interest in and an active role in saving from national enemies. In the book of Psalms, we looked at this afternoon, there are occasional prayers for the savage defeat of enemies. But there are also prayers which and statements which clearly express the futility of war and military defense. I just draw your attention to just one of those, summarizing a bit from the Psalms. Psalm 33, find this reference, Psalm 33, verses 39 and 40. Now there's something, got my numbers wrong there. There aren't that many verses there. I guess it was 37. That is the reference which we used this afternoon. It isn't the one I'm looking for now. That is, the salvation of the righteous comes from the Lord. No, it's 33:16, if you have a Bible and want to look at it. 33:16 following. This Psalm 33 is a very comprehensive view of life and the world and what's going on and what it all means. And it begins with praise and worship. It centers our life and suggests to me that the meaning of our life starts with the praise of God for His goodness and greatness. That's where it begins. Then it goes on to speak about the greatness of God in many ways. And then, verse 13, we see God taking a look at His world. And we read it this way. The Lord looks down from heaven. He sees all the sons of men. From where He sits enthroned, He looks forth on all the inhabitants of the earth. He who fashions the hearts of them all and observes all their deeds. A king is not saved by his great army. A warrior is not delivered by his great strength. A war horse is a vain hope for victory, and by its great might it cannot save. I want to pause there to comment on these verses. It's an interesting thing that when the Lord looks down from heaven and sees the people He's made and apparently surveys everything they're doing, He seems to be impressed by the military enterprise there. Because the next words have to do with the king and his mighty armies and the war horse. I would think that God would be pretty hard of seeing if He would look at the world today and what's going on and not be impressed with the military enterprise, with the size of it all, when He looks what humans are putting their hands to. And so it appears that, as the psalmist is saying, God looked and saw what was going on and felt it necessary to say that a king is not saved by his great army, a warrior is not delivered by his great strength. But then He goes on to say where salvation does lie, and how people can be saved from enemies. Verse 18, behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear Him, on those who hope in His steadfast love, that He may deliver their soul from death and keep them alive in famine. So that is a basic statement of the psalmist's faith. He believes that the eye of the Lord is on those who fear Him to deliver them. And then the psalmist concludes with another affirmation or statement of his commitment and his faith. Our soul waits for the Lord. Last week we talked about waiting for the Lord. Why is it that God seems so far away or doesn't act when we are in trouble? And we said this term wait for the Lord is a very common term for some reason in Scripture. Our soul waits for the Lord. He is our help and shield. Yea, our heart is glad in him because we trust in his holy name. Let thy steadfast love, O Lord, be upon us, even as we hope in thee. I think in these verses there are very clear and specific choices, contrast between where people can put their trust. We could trust in the king's great army and the warrior. We could trust in the war horse. But the psalmist says we trust in God, in God's holy name. Well then, I believe the Psalms are an expression of Israel's faith and experience. And a foundational experience for Israel was the deliverance from Egypt, from oppression in Egypt. And that's the Exodus. And now I would like to turn to the book of Exodus and look at this formative experience in Israel's history. Israel, throughout all the years of the composition of Scripture, the writing of the Bible, and ever since, the Jews today look to the Exodus as the decisive event in their history. The reality with which the book of Exodus begins is the reality of enslavement by enemies. The people of Israel are in Egypt, and they are oppressed there. Chapter 1, verses 11 and 12 say, Egyptians set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens, and they built for Pharaoh store cities, Python, Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, the more they spread abroad, and the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. The Egyptians were afraid of rebellion on the part of the Israelites whom they held in bondage. So the first reality there is oppression. And a particular heinous example of that oppression is given next, in which Pharaoh tells the Hebrew midwives to kill any male children who are born, so that the Israelites will not multiply, and particularly will not have males for warriors, for battle, I presume. But an interesting thing here in verse 17, it says, but the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. An interesting example there of civil disobedience and on the part of women a long time ago, little nonviolent resistance to the direction in which the oppressor was trying to take the children of Israel. Now, the Hebrew midwives are a fine example of people who feared God and went on to disobey the king's command. And brings to mind wise men in the story in the book of Matthew who did something the same thing. They were told by Herod, you know, to go and find the Christ child and come back and tell him where they found him. And they had a dream. The Lord told them not to go back but to go on to another way, and so they did that. A lot of stuff to think about in that story. You know, too often after we've heard the king's edict, we've heard the national law, the imperial decree, we don't get a vision from the Lord after that. We think we've heard it all. But they heard another voice and went another direction. And I'm still waiting to see a bumper sticker, which at Christmas time, you know, which says, wise men still disobey kings. We've seen one that says wise men still seek him, and I think they do still seek Jesus, but they also still have to disobey kings sometimes if they're going to go Jesus' way. Well, this oppression in Egypt, well, if the first reality was Israel's enslavement by enemies, the second exciting reality there is God's compassion. Chapter 2, verses 23 following, we read these interesting words. In the course of those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned under their bondage and cried out for help. And their cry under bondage came up to God. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God saw the people of Israel, and God knew their condition. There are three verbs there. You can, if you count remember, you have four. But at least three verbs there, which show God's awareness of what was happening. God's awareness of this oppression and his concern about it. God heard, God saw, and God knew, it says. These three are repeated in the next chapter, verse 7. Chapter 3, verse 7. And this time in the mouth of the Lord. Then the Lord said, I have seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings. So there are the three, seen, heard, know. Now a fourth one is added. And I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land, that land, to a good and broad land. So the point is that God had compassion on people suffering oppression. I suppose for us the question is, do we believe that God still hears today when people suffer oppression? And what do we think God does about that hearing, or when he hears, if you think he does hear? I just pose that question. I think it's something we can talk about later. But now I want us to look at the Red Sea deliverance, the actual Exodus event. I think I may need some water here. I don't know. I guess I'll get it going. There are about six stages I would identify in this Red Sea deliverance. And I think the importance of these stages or these parts of that deliverance is that it wasn't just a one-time event, but it was then in Israel's history repeated time and again as they were people of faith and as they looked to God. So I'll identify these six stages. The first, we've already mentioned in a way, is the cry to God for deliverance. The book of Exodus begins basically with this cry to God for help. In the Old Testament history, the word cry had a kind of a special technical meaning, I believe. I haven't read that recently, just a specific definition, but I think if a person was attacked by bandits, say, along an abandoned road, and if that person raised a cry for help, anyone who heard it was morally obliged to respond and to help. If that cry went up, and I don't know whether it was a certain word or something, but if the cry went out, any other person hearing it had to respond. And here God is saying, it is said of God that, or rather, the point is made that Egypt the children of Israel in Egypt, issued a cry. Their cry went up to God. I don't have the psalm in front of me. I wish I remembered the number of the psalm, which talks about this. Thank you for that water. One of the psalms basically says that Israel's unfaithfulness is evidenced by the fact that they haven't cried to God for help. They've turned almost everywhere except to God. In fact, I think the point is even a little more focused than that, that the specific disobedience of Israel is, or no, more their failure in adequate worship, their failure to worship God as they should, is their failure to cry to God for help. They are criticized for all of their worship rituals. You're giving me sacrifices, and you're giving me prayers, and this and that, in sort of a ritual way, but you have not asked me, you have not cried out to me for salvation. In effect, you have not confessed your dependence on me and your need of me. So, the first point on the Exodus story is that the cry to God went up. If you have a Bible and want to turn to chapter 14, most of the specific steps now of this deliverance are in chapter 14. The second thing that happens, and it's one I think we could identify with, is in verse 10, chapter 14. And this is the people experience fear. When Pharaoh drew near, people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they were in great fear. Then it goes on to say how the people cried out to Moses and said, "What'd you do bringing us out here in this wilderness to die? We could have died just as well back where we were, and it would have been much simpler." So they're filled with fear. Well, what is a more characteristic human response to enemies than fear? And you can almost ask, what emotion, what state of heart or mind is more characteristic of our society than fear? Indeed, covered over and papered over and painted over with all kinds of things. But just an awful lot of very deep-seated fear of enemies. And so the children of Israel were afraid. So that is, in a sense, a way of saying that faith in God was difficult for them, as it is for us. Fear is a very natural response. But then the next step is a statement of faith that God would save them. A statement of faith that God, in fact, had an interest in this. And you have that in verses 13 and 14. When the people are done stating their fears and complaining to Moses about being brought out into this wilderness. Verse 13, "And Moses said to the people, 'Fear not, stand firm, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be still.'" So, that was a statement of faith that God would act in the situation and deliver them. But the fourth step is an act of faith on Israel's part. You know, they sort of had a statement of faith, but then they also had an act of faith. They had to do something. It's interesting how that's expressed here. The next words in the story are, The Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward. Lift up your rod, stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the people of Israel may go on dry ground through the sea." So the Lord says, "Well, that's enough for prayer now, enough for crying. A move. Why do you cry? Move, take a step." And I think that that is also instructive for us. But, we're not, when we're speaking faith in God, we are not speaking of idleness, of disengagement, of being passive and inactive. But there is much to do. It takes acts of faith as well as words. The next and fifth thing would be the reality of God's deliverance. God's deliverance happens. God acts, and the people do walk through in the dry ground, and the Egyptians are, and their horses, see it says, the Egyptians pursued, went in after them in the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And they went all went into the sea, and then the pillar of fire, in the morning watch, the Lord, the pillar of fire in the cloud, looked down upon the host of the Egyptians and discomfited the host of the Egyptians, clogging their chariot wheels, they drove heavily. And the sea returned, and the Egyptian army was destroyed. There you had a very specific and physical destruction of Israel's enemies and physical deliverance of the people of Israel. We'll talk later about some of the implications of that. But finally, out of this, sixthly, you have praise to God, an expression of thanks, of praise to God for what he has done in delivering his people from oppression. And that's in chapter 15, the Song of Moses. I'll just read a few verses of it. "I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation." Isn't that interesting, that use of the word salvation? The Lord was their salvation, he said. But what had he done for them? Had he forgiven their sins and come into their hearts and given new life and new birth? Perhaps he had, but what we're told about here is that he had saved them from the oppression of enemies and had delivered them. "This is my God, and I will praise him, my father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his host he cast into the sea. His picked officers are sunk in the Red Sea." Verse 6, "Thy right hand, O Lord, glorious in power. Thy right hand, O Lord, shatters the enemy. Who is like thee, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like thee, majestic in holiness, terrible in glorious deeds, doing wonders?" Well, I will conclude by mentioning three other events in the history of Israel, which were the same kind of event, a sort of recapitulation. A working again of this deliverance, this salvation. And in each of these, I think you see an interesting sort of look at the divine and human roles in dealing with national enemies. The three events are the story of David and Goliath, and of Jehoshaphat and Jehaziel. The king was Jehoshaphat, and the Levite who spoke God's word was Jehaziel. And the third event was the story of Gideon. Now, what all three of those have in common might be summarized for us in Deuteronomy chapter 20. Each of those three events were occasions when Israel had a national enemy that had to be dealt with. And so they have to do with the question of war and military defense. The book of Deuteronomy gives some rules of war for Israel, for God's people. And these rules of war, like each of the three stories we'll look at, could have only one purpose, which was preserve and make visible God's miraculous role in the defense of Israel. Very strange rules of war, Deuteronomy 20. When you go forth to war against your enemies, see horses, chariots, and an army larger than your own, you shall not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God is with you, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And when you draw near to the battle, the priest shall come forward and speak to the people, and shall say to them, Hear, O Israel, you draw near this day to battle against your enemies. Let not your heart faint, do not fear or tremble, or be in dread of them. For the Lord your God is he that goes with you, to fight for you against your enemies, to give you the victory. So, the priest is to go forward and address the people and address their fears particularly. Don't be afraid, he says to them. And then the officers shall speak to the people saying, Well, this would be the people out of whom the army is, the recruits are to be taken. Speak to the people. What man is there that has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in battle and another man dedicate it. And what man is there that has planted a vineyard and has not enjoyed its fruit? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in battle and another man enjoy its fruit. And what man is there that has betrothed a wife and has not taken her? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man take her. So here are all these human enterprises, you know, things people do, enjoy doing, and the meaning of life is found in these things. If anybody has started on any of these wonderful new enterprises, why, they should go and do that. But let's not take them off to war. We'll do without them. And the officer shall speak further to people and say, What man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? How's that for a good way to address, you know, the young recruits and those who might be headed to war? Whoever is fearful and faint-hearted, let him go back to his house, lest the heart of his fellows melt as his heart. And when the officers have made an end of speaking to the people, then commanders shall be appointed at the head of the people. So that's a strange way of putting together an army, let's face it. that was the instruction for going off to war. We won't read the rest of it. The next part is, you shall offer peace to your enemy. That's the first step. And see whether you can avoid the conflict.
Once you win, you get kind of bloody.
Pardon?
So once you win, you get kind of bloody.
Let's say a little more about that.
I'll just read right here. Then when the Lord your God lets you capture the city, kill every man in it. You may, however, take for yourselves the women, the children, the livestock, and everything in the city.
Yeah. That is what has been called the law of holy war. It's kind of a sacrifice of everything to God. And it's a great problem. At least it is
like
for
a
me.
Sacrifice to God to me. That sounds like slaughter.
Okay.
Sounds like a crusade.
Yeah. I think That's a good way to describe it.
It means God will sort out who is right and wrong. You just kill them all.
I think we definitely should spend some time on that question. I'm not sure whether we should do it right now. Let's come back to the crusade idea, the holy war question, and see how that relates to questions of modern war or just war and pacifism. Just to summarize, we need to conclude my presentation in 2 or 3 minutes. I'm only going to give the references for the David and Goliath story. In fact, I've written them up here. David and Goliath in 1 Samuel 17 is really a remarkable story of unilateral disarmament, as in a sense the other three also are, where David is totally ill-equipped. But at the end of the account, the purpose for all of that is stated. It's so that all Israel, and I think it says all the nations, may know that God is Lord, or that God has power. In Jehaziel, the story of Jehaziel in 2 Chronicles 20, if any of you were here Friday evening, we read that story in the Vespers. Again, simply and profoundly, an account of Israel threatened by enemies, and the Levite, Jehaziel, stands up and says, it's a time to trust the Lord for deliverance. And so they sing praise to God, and they experience God's deliverance. And the Gideon story in Judges chapter 7, that's a familiar story to you. That's another time where Gideon's army was pared down from something like 300,000 to 300. And they pretty well, 20 rules of war, asked all these questions. They sent everybody home who had recently married, and sent anybody who recently built a house. And finally, everybody who's afraid was sent home, and they were left with 300. And out of it, again, the point that is made is that Yahweh, God, is powerful and saves his people from the enemies. Well, I'm going to conclude there. And back here is
I have a little problem in this respect. And now, the nation of Israel was not necessarily geographically defined. It was a group of God's chosen people. I suppose in a certain sense we could say a parallel would be the Christians today. And the wars that were fought or were prevented and so on that we're talking about were against a particular people of God and the non-people of God. Now, we don't have a situation like that exactly today. We are a part of a nation. I will put it this way. Take, for instance, in a communist country such as Russia, where there has been persecution of an element, say the Christians there, in various forms, as we know. There, of course, the only recourse they had was to accept, shall I say, the suffering, the suffering, and so on. And I think they've done that. Many of them have done it very well. But take America, for instance. In a certain sense, the people of God, I mean, the converted or the committed children, those who would say, who we would say are Christians, are in a sense a minority. Our nation is a bigger thing than that. And I can't quite see the parallel between the situation there and our situation.
Well, Yes, sure. There are great differences. However, I'm reaching for and invite your thoughts, critiques, and ideas is how the church today, and let's say the Christians today, can keep what and maintain what seems to have been present as a seed in Israel's earliest life, and as we look on, I think, at Isaiah and on through history, what grew in them was their sense of trust in God for salvation, not only from personal sin, but also from physical national enemies. How can the church preserve that reality today and bear witness to that?
Can I ask you a question? What would you have liked the church to do when Hitler was in Germany?
Well, I would like the church in Germany to have resisted Hitler, to have done a lot of civil disobedience in Germany, like the Hebrew midwives.
But do you think that would have stopped Hitler?
Well, I think it might have. Hitler only became what he could became because thousands, I suppose, millions of people made him that. And thousands, if not millions, of those people were called themselves Christians, Christian people. And they did not resist what Hitler was about. They bought his line of restoring power and pride to Germany after national humiliation, World War I, and they did not resist it. I think to have done that would have been very costly for the church, would have involved a great deal of suffering.
I don't know enough, and maybe there's somebody in this room or you know more about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. How many supporters, followers were involved in his stand?
Well, it was a very small number, but he was part of what's called the Confessing Church in Germany.
The allegiance in Germany came before the bad part. You couldn't see it. I mean, he developed the national pride and the support of the people. They didn't know what was ahead. Isn't this correct?
Oh, sure.
Even the persecution of Jews. In other words, they had no idea what. But once he got control, wasn't much they could do anymore. They didn't know what he was going to do.
Well, it's not as if they couldn't have known anything about what he was about.
He wrote a little book, Mein Kampf.
He didn't switch like that overnight. The seeds of what he became were in what he was doing early on. Of course, it was the challenge of seeing that. It's always a challenge of God's people. It's sort of the challenge of prophetic insight, of who interprets the situation truly? Who is speaking the word of God into what is happening here and now? I think that is the essence of prophecy. I think prophecy is not so much predicting the unknown distant future as it is truly understanding and interpreting the meaning of the present. Of course, that has implications for the future. The future grows out of the present.
But you think this is where the fear came in?
Whether they wished to recognize what
was coming or not,
there
was
the
fear of going against Hitler and
what that would mean as far as personal reprisal. I'm sure there was. It's always a very risky thing.
But it's not so much the rise of Hitler we're talking about, but I would like to know, what would you think we as Christians should have done was just in 1940, after it was very bold. Should we say, leave it up to God? I mean, let him go. He will eventually be punished. let it go on.
No, I think that then all the Christians should have withdrawn cooperation at a whole range of points. Would have been difficult and costly. But as I hear the story, there were few pastors, for example, who were ready to take the risk and the burden of denouncing, well, maybe that's even too strong a word, but exposing.
I mean those outside of Germany.
He's talking about those outside of Germany.
Yeah, okay. Should the Allies have declared war on Germany, yes or no? That's basically all the answer.
No, not with military means. Yes, with nonviolent resistance of all kinds.
How can we nonviolently resist Hitler in the United States? By not selling any potatoes to them?
Well, by not selling military material to them, anyway. We could talk about today, how the United States should fight. Who's the enemy today? Hitler's gone. The communists were helping the Allies defeat Hitler in Second World War.
How about what's going on in Afghanistan, for instance, today? What should be our role?
Well, I'm not sure that we have a great role in Afghanistan, apart from denouncing the oppression, the invasion, making a clear statement that we oppose that, consider it wrong. But I don't think even the United States, with all of its power, can be everywhere with a solution to problems. I don't know. What do you think the United States should be doing?
I'm just concerned because it seems like we're pretty much ignoring it. We're putting our heads in the sand, and while we're talking about World War II and how these atrocities were going on in the Holocaust, we remain silent as a nation, and there's been kind of a lot of discussion of that lately, and yet here's something happening currently, and it's happening, and yet we're doing the same thing. We're putting our heads in the sand, and it's happening in Southeast Asia. With again, civilizations, it's a genocide all over again. And there seems to be a need for something other than a military solution, and that's what I'm grasping for. What can be done? In some areas it can be an economic sanction or whatever, but what can we do when we see these things happening today?
I just would like a little more clarification from the questioners as to whether the question is what should the United States be doing in the world today, or what should the Christian church be in a broken world? I don't know that Christians can control today what a whole national entity will do, but our Christians, our people of God, call to a certain or a range of ministry in a broken world.
I'm not going to. I think you've asked the right question in terms of the church's response. That's our primary agenda, our primary task and role. But that has implications for how we act as citizens of the nation in which we happen to live. I'd like to come back briefly to the question about the holy war, or unholy war, whatever you want to call it, crusade in the Old Testament, the slaughter of men, women, and children. That occurs at a couple places in this story, in the record of the Old Testament. And I find that, I consider that, one of the most, on the one hand, perhaps one of the most bizarre and striking examples of God's accommodation to human weakness in revealing himself. War was a human institution way back then, and it was the way that people dealt with enemies. And so Israel, and I think God allowed Israel in some ways, accommodate himself to them to see him working through war. Beyond that, though, I think those stories always make it very clear that the death of all of those people was in God's hands. And that gets to all the questions of why the death of anyone. Yes. And I guess my belief, my commitment is to leave death in God's hands, and to leave that kind of story behind. I don't find anything in Jesus or in God's later work with his people that looks anything like that. So I see no need for us either fully to explain why that happened then, and certainly far less need for us to find any way to recreate that experience today.
I think what you're saying is if God gives life, he has the right to take life.
Yes.
But we don't have the right to take the life unless he says we have. And
yes.
He has directed man to take life.
Right. And the question of whether he ever directs man to take life, I personally don't believe that he does, but to those who believe that he does sometimes, my only appeal is that we hedge that idea as carefully as Israel did with processes of consulting God and making sure that God is saying, well, yes, now's the time to go to war, and making sure that we have done all the disarmament things and sent home all those who are scared and married a wife and so forth. So in effect, we make it impossible to win the battle.